Financial Group.
Hour two of your triumphant return edition of Justice and Drew is underway. 651-989-5855 is the phone number, or you can use #250 on your mobile device and just say TCNT. Also, jump on Twitter and use that hashtag TCNT to communicate with the show at any time.
There is a... let's bring on Andrew Andrew Langer, president of the Institute for Liberty, host of the LangerCast, powered by Randy's Electric. Hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving with your family there, Andrew Langer.
I had a great weekend. You know, my honorary Langer sister was in town with her husband, and we all did the festivities together. It's always fun to be around with them.
There's a fun one here, real quick, out of Daily Wire. So there was a teenager, and this was in he joined a bunch of students. He was from Iran, right? At Stoke High School in Ipswich. It's a county town of Suffolk, England, right? Students and parents immediately noticed that something was off with the teenager, right? 15 years old. Savash is his name. He was 6'1", had stubble and a large Adam's apple and a hairline that some viewed as receding.
And he was alleging to be 15.
That's right. Students and parents believe the teen was probably closer to 30 than he was to 15. When parents began complaining that an adult man was in school with their underage children, they say their concerns were dismissed as racist.
As racist?
Yes. So apparently this all comes down to this Savash benefiting from Britain's generous asylum system, which has been found to be abused by those seeking a free education by posing as minors. And I guess this particular student... was like checking out the teenage girls in the school. One parent said she was told the man sat on a bench during lunch near teenage girls just looking. One student said that he actually started FaceTiming with the female student, sending her messages asking how close she lived to the school.
Okay, that's creepy.
I know, right?
All right. I was going to make a Drew Barrymore Drew Barrymore reference to Never Been Kissed, but I don't think I'm going to go there with this story.
Yeah.
Because I just don't think that would be appropriate.
No.
It really is more like Matthew McConaughey in Dazed and Confused.
Yes. Yes. Critics have long pointed out that the rules create incentive for adult migrants to simply destroy ID papers and pose as vulnerable children. Indeed, several of the young men who disembarked on one of these coaches appeared to be square-jawed men in their 20s or 30s. And these are people seeking asylum in England. But I thought it was funny / interesting, especially given the situation that we're dealing with asylum seekers doing nothing with my fingers on our own southern border. And the amount of blue check marks in media that are losing their minds over us actually pushing back on individuals that are actually trying to break in through our points of entry.
Well, I mean, John, let's also look at it another way. I mean, we can tie that aspect into it. But then there's also these other stories that we're now seeing about people who are trying to push the boundaries of self-identity by identifying as different ages that they are. So, I mean, you know, listen, if one can defy your genetic gender, then why can't you defy the time? So maybe Savash, you know, believes that he is truly, you know, 15 years old. And who is the government of Great Britain to judge how he self-identifies?
Oh, man, you know, you're joking, but it's like I can see that sort of mindset being accepted. If you're allowed to identify by whatever you want, what is to stop somebody? What is to stop a creepy 35-year-old man to say, you know, I identify as a 17-year-old boy and I'd like to go to high school?
You know, this is why I've become so interested in the writings of Jenna Ellis with the James Dobson Family Institute. She wrote a book called... The moral case for the Constitution is just sort of talking about these issues. She's a lawyer. She's doing a lot of stuff on Fox these days, but she really is trying to sort of make the case as to why we have these rational, objective truths. Now, I know it's within the construct of faith, which in and of itself, it's a matter of faith, but we have to recognize that there are objective facts out there. And the problem, of course, right, Drew, to drill down into the story, is remember the pushback on this is if you don't accept this the reality of non-objective truth, well, then that means that you're a racist, you're a sexist, you're a homophobe, you're whatever. And that's clearly not the case, right? You look at a 30-year-old Iranian guy who identifies as a 15-year-old, and you're like, no, he's 30, he does not belong here, because there are objective truths that are at work.
Well, and when I originally saw the story, I honestly thought it was more along the lines of another story we'd seen where there was a guy who was 50 years old and said he wanted to self-identify as somebody who was in his 30s. And there was a whole article written about how this individual was saying, well, listen, you know, if we can be, you know, gender fluid, then I don't want to identify as a person who's in his, you know, mid to late 60s. I'm going to identify myself as being a 30-year-old. And I mean, again, that's a bit of a, you know, using that as a joke. I thought that's what this story was about. But we are in a situation right now where, you know, we're kind of looking at these things that used to be standards as gray areas, and we really shouldn't. And it crosses beyond even the story that we were talking about. I mean, going back to the border issue and this idea that in this particular circumstance, suddenly the rules change because you have a bunch of people that are showing up at the border seeking asylum as opposed to a singular individual. And just we're nuking standards, and it's not a good thing.
Well, no, I mean, we can sort of talk about invasion tactics and how that works, but it really is the crux as to why identity politics and identitarian politics is so destructive, not just to the political process, but to sort of the very fabric of society. When you start to, you know, when it was something that we, for in our republic for many years, now listen, we could talk about America's racial and racist history, but when we did and go down those roads where we really chose to segregate and identify people by race, it was fundamentally destructive. And every time we sort of worked very hard and diligently to break down the barriers of race, to break down the barriers of identity, and sort of say, no, we are all here, we are Americans, and we are Americans because not because of our skin color or because of our religion or because of X, Y, and Z genetic point, mm-hmm. or philosophical point. We are all Americans because we identify, we believe in a common idea.
There's not a country in the world that has done a better job of creating opportunities for anybody, regardless of your race, regardless of your religion, regardless of your gender. Does that mean we're perfect? No. There are still, you know, there's still racist individuals. There always will be, spoiler alert. But, you know, there's not a country in the world that's done a better job than the United States when it comes to creating more opportunities and giving anybody from any background, whether they just entered this country for the first time, whether they were born here, whatever their story or identity is, you have the opportunity to make something great of your life, and you just don't have that everywhere else in the world.
No, and that's exactly right, Drew, and that's why you have to have a respect for the rule of law, right? And I get it. There are people who genuinely need to come here because they're trying to seek safety. Absolutely true. And there are people who really do want to risk everything to come here. I get that. The problem then becomes, once we have the breakdown of the rule of law, then we sort of destroy, we sort of serve to undercut the very institutions that serve to make America this exceptional nation. So you have to follow the process, and let it work. Plus, you know, if we do, because we get, you know, thousands of people coming on the border, and all of a sudden we decide we're going to shortchange the legal entry process to the United States, well, the folks who did have the respect for this nation, did wait in line, well, that serves to completely undercut their efforts, and it creates a massive disincentive to following the rules. Why would you follow the rules if rule breaking is rewarded?
Well, and we're living in a very, this is an understatement, but we're living in a very confused time right now. And getting back to the identity politics aspect of it, let me use the talking about the border issue for a moment and spin it back to what we were just discussing. You know, you go to Twitter and you look at a bunch of blue check marks talking about how using tear gas against those seeking asylum, you know, is against the very thing that this country stands for, completely ignoring, Right. The real reality of what's happening on the border and the reason why these things are taking place. But when you look at the way that Twitter is handling people's different views, right? So you have Jesse Kelly, and we're going to talk to him later on this week, has been banned from Twitter. He does not know why. I think we can all kind of guess. People obviously complained about a lot of his tweets where he offers up different, a difference in viewpoints. There's a story that we have later on this morning where a progressive feminist was suspended from Twitter after criticizing the transgender movement. Twitter can do whatever Twitter wants to do, but talk about sending a very confusing, conflicting message out into the public over individuals that think that Twitter is a place for free speech, that everything should be allowed. Well, if they're banning it, then that stuff must be bad. I mean, it's really confusing these issues.
I am wondering, right, yes, it's absolutely true that Twitter is a private entity and a private corporation. And you enter into and you create your Twitter account voluntarily. You can always leave at any time. But the reality is, there's something else at work here. And I'm just sort of formulating this theory, sort of thinking about it, in light of what happened to Jesse Kelly and this bizarre Star Chamber situation. Twitter makes money off of your personal information. How you tweet, who gets to tweet at you, who gets to target you, they make money off of your membership. And what happens is there's a relationship that forms in which, you as an individual, a lot of people do make money off of may they magnify their image based upon their Twitter followers. It's part and parcel of their business. And so I'm wondering, if there is something that there's a remedy at law, given the fact that Twitter makes money off of you. I think there may be some sort of fraudulent cause of action here. Hmm. Twitter makes money off of you, and then they have this sort of Star Chamber way of kicking you off for whatever reason without any notice. There's something fundamentally wrong about that. I don't know. As I said, I'm just sort of getting at this. What bothers me is this Star Chamber mentality that, you can have, I don't know how many followers Jesse Kelly had. My suspicion was probably several thousand.
I think relied on Twitter 70,000.
50,000. There you go.
Yeah, 70,000.
All of a sudden, to have that gone, I mean, there's something I think inherently dishonest about that, and so there may be a cause of action under the FTC for that.
Well, and this is opening up a can of worms, and I may be completely off base with this, and it wasn't where we were going today, but since we're here, when it comes to particular stories, okay, fairy tales, they end up eventually becoming public domain. Right. Your stories by Hans Christian Andersen, your Little Mermaids. I think there's even a version of Frozen. A lot of these particular stories are public domain because they've been out there for so long. Do you think we're heading to a place where you have an entity like Twitter that is used by so many people that it ends up almost becoming sort of a public forum where you may be a private entity that owns this, but we've reached a level now where so many people, so much of humanity is on it now that it's considered a public space, in which case you are limiting free speech. Do you think that's a possibility in any realm?
I would hate to go down that road. Here's where I come back to this. And I don't look at it from the public utility perspective, because I know a lot of folks are talking about that with Facebook.
Sure.
And to some extent with Google.
I'm not saying I agree with that, by the way. I'm just putting it out there.
No. I get that. It's a good hypothetical. That's why I sort of approach it. Remember, all businesses have to operate in a way that does not abuse their customers' rights. That's why we have things like the FTC engaging in ensuring the fraudulent behavior is not tolerated on the marketplace. But the other side of it is, right, the four of us, including Sam, know that the only way this kind of power is supplanted is through competition in the marketplace, which is why I don't like sort of going after this in the antitrust format. But the problem comes in when businesses like Twitter and Google and Facebook are able to use their inherent power, their market power, to keep competitors from the marketplace. Right? You know, Snapchat, get your Instagram, they're powerful, but listen, MySpace got supplanted by Facebook, and for a lot of reasons, probably because Mark Zuckerberg was smarter than our friend Tom at MySpace.
but he's one of my top seven friends.
That these companies turn around and can mine the data in such a way as to use that to their competitive advantage and keep their competitors out of the marketplace. That's sort of where the rule of law is supposed to be able to step in. Essentially, the laws are not supposed to protect cronyism. They're supposed to help foster a level playing field. And so we have to ensure that it's not once they become sort of a public domain, John. It's once they start engaging in cronyist behavior and keeping their competitors out of the marketplace, that's where we have a problem with it.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And there's this idea that Twitter and Facebook are so big now that they will always be there. And that's just not the case.
No.
I mean, something will come along, maybe not supplant them, but will certainly take away some of the power and influence that they have. But it does feel like there is a concerted effort to kind of slowly, little drip, drip, drip at a time, purge Twitter of conservative voices, purge Facebook of conservative voices.
Well, I mean, Drew, I mean, let's remember, this is ultimately a goal of the progressive left, is to engage in deplatforming, right?
Exactly.
That's exactly. This is what they do on college campuses. And so the shadow ban movement, the out and out ban, the star chamber bans of guys like Jesse Kelly, that is a form of deplatforming.
Well, and Jesse, real quick, hey, can you hang on the line, by the way?
Sure, I can.
Okay, Hey, hang on. Talking with Andrew Langer. We'll get into more of this with Andrew Langer. But real quick, the one point I was going to make was Jesse Kelly called this out. He wrote that article in the Federalist after what happened to Alex Jones. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't you know it, the same thing ended up happening to him. Like, it was not a self-fulfilling prophecy, but he prophesied this was going to happen.
And this is why when we stood up and we defended Alex Jones, when people stood up and defended Alex Jones's right to tweet, people, why are you defending him? He's horrible. Pick another hill to die on. And we said, and we weren't alone, a lot of people said, if you think they're going to stop with Alex Jones,
right?
If you think they're going to be satisfied with Alex Jones, no, you just wait. This is the beginning, and we were absolutely right. More with Andrew Langer.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Justice and Drew, along with Sam, Andrew Langer, president of the Institute for Liberty, was kind enough to hang on the line with us. So we worked through some of the issues from over our extended Thanksgiving weekend. Real quick, we're going to get into this a little bit later on in the show, but I know that we know you wanted to talk a bit about that climate change report that dropped on Black Friday. Yeah, I don't know if you know this, and Drew, I don't know if you know this, but you know the administration dropped it on Black Friday to bury it.
Right.
To bury the climate change report because it contradicts what how the president feels about climate change.
Did a great job burying it. Yeah, nobody heard about it.
No, not at all. No.
And the irony, of course, was it's really funny because Politico, which is where I read the story, their headline was that it was Trump's climate report. I mean, I found that hysterical. I literally, the headline, Trump's climate report, contradicts Trump's own view. I'm trying to figure out just how Trump releases a report. Here's what I come back to. The media can't have it both ways, right? They cannot say say that Trump needs to be independent, or these agencies, you have to let these agencies act independently, and then at the same time sort of assign this report to him. It's very, very disingenuous. But to me, right, in the end, this comes right on the heels of a major news story from last week in which the big climate alarmist report from over the summer, the one that said that the oceans were warming at 3+ times the rate that scientists had previously predicted, that report had to get retracted because there were massive math errors discovered, incidentally, by a climate skeptic that the left would rather see silenced. And so you have this one alarmist report that had to get walked back, and now we have this other one. And it's interesting because if you drill down, and a number of folks have, again, once again, the math doesn't the math doesn't bear out the alarmism of the report itself.
Well, and what we're, you know, what's old is new again, and what we're seeing, at least in my opinion, and like I said, we're going to dive into this a little bit further, is with this climate report, you have the Ilhan Omars, you have the Ocasio-Cortez presenting their new Green Deal. We'll get to this here in a second. Kamala Harris and Cory Booker looking at their basic income plans, likely to remove work incentive, according to a think tank. Look, these are all means to push socialism without being upfront about pushing socialism. And that's how I see it. It's like we're going down this road again where, well, we're probably not going to be able to convince the general public to buy into this whole idea of socialism. So we'll go ahead and start pushing global warming and climate change again. And we'll get it that way. We'll get it through these social net programs as well.
Well, I mean, listen, as my old mentor and boss, Fred Smith, from the Competitive Enterprise Institute used to say, you know, if it's something that the left has been pushing or something that somebody has been pushing since before the crisis du jour occurred, and they're merely adapting their agenda to the new crisis, then you know that it has that the crisis itself doesn't really exist, and it's merely sort of window dressing for the packaging here, right? Most of the stuff that the left has been talking about, whether it or not it is, you know, greater fuel efficiency or better electricity efficiency or, you know, getting consumers to use less, all of this stuff has been part and parcel of the green environmentalist agenda since the early 1970s. And of course, you know, they forget that the whole nature of technology and innovation and productivity advances is to get us to do more with less. And if you just let the market do its job, we will be doing more with less. But to sort of shortchange us, listen, it's so funny because the irony that this report comes out, and remember, what they want to do fundamentally is raise the cost of energy to individuals, right? This is what Stephen Chu, who was President Obama's first energy secretary, wanted to do. He wanted to see gas prices raised to about $6 a gallon. We're seeing gas prices at not record lows, but lower than they've been in a long time, happening right now. Imagine if gas were three times as expensive as it is, and the impact that is. And of course, the irony is that we're seeing these massive protests right now in France over the French government trying to raise the gas taxes over there. People around the world get this. You need inexpensive, reliable sources of energy in order to make an economy run. When you artificially try to jack up the prices, it has impacts on real people.
And to go back to your earlier point, look, if these were really good ideas, if these were genuinely good ideas, first of all, you can make the argument that they wouldn't need to be implemented by government, but that's a separate argument. But they wouldn't need to couch them in all of their sort of social justice language that they do. If the remedies for climate change that are so often proposed were genuinely good, positive ideas, they wouldn't need to be co-opted and couched into, well, you know, climate change disproportionately affects minorities. And the poor.
Well, you know, the flip side of that, Drew, is, you know, you can sort of make that sort of couching as to how poor communities are impacted by environmental stressors. But the reality is the direct and palpable result is that it is low income and minority people that are disproportionately harmed by rising energy prices. The poor are least able to handle these kinds of spikes. Now, of course, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes will then turn around and say, well, this is why we need to then turn around and subsidize these spikes, much in the same way that they've done for healthcare. And, of course, the reaction should be, well, look at what happened. When you massively subsidized health insurance for poor people, the cost of insurance skyrocketed for everybody. We really want Obamacare to start happening with energy in America.
Before we let you go, just a quick question on this that we had. Are we looking at a situation right now when some of the key Democrats, when you look at your Booker, you look at your Harris, and individuals that are pushed forward as being the front runners for 2020 as presidential Democratic Democrat candidates, Are we just in a cycle right now where these are the most progressive that are getting the attention, or are we looking at a situation where moderate Dems are, at least for the time being, a thing of the past, and we can just simply expect the prominent leaders of the Democratic Party to be the far left progressives?
Well, I mean, this gets into this question about sort of how the coastal elites have taken over the Democratic Party. I mean, this is they sort of have this expectation, and that's where you get candidates like Beto O'Rourke in Texas who are out of touch with sort of that moderate. If the Democrats wanted to go after moderate, gettable Republicans, you know, the Beto O'Rourkes of the world are not those guys who are going to do it. The real issue is. You know, the Republican Party went through this with the Tea Party movement and sort of the refinements there. The Democrats are going to go through these same kind of growing pains. The real question is how that translates into this reelect. Are we going to see essentially what happened in 2012 for the Republicans, where, you know, you had a somewhat crowded field of a number of different folks trying to tilt at Barack Obama, and nobody really gaining traction? You know, will the Democrats get someone who can effectively translate that message in a way that appeals to the broadest base of voters out there? I'm just not so sure.
No.
Yeah. I'm going with a no.
Yeah.
Andrew Langer, president of the Institute for Liberty. Thanks for giving us a little extra time this morning. Good to catch up with you.
Always happy to, guys. Talk to you next week.
Look forward to talking with you next week.
We will get into, because they're fun to mock because they're so ridiculous, some of the basic income plans for Kamala and Harris. We'll talk.
Terrible idea.
We'll talk about, also a terrible idea, Amy Klobuchar running for the presidency. It's not going to keep the Star Tribune from encouraging her to do so.
Yeah, we're back here.
Yeah, yes, we are.
About once a month, you're going to get this article.
Today.
AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Welcome back to your Monday edition of Justice and Drew. In about 20 minutes, we'll be joined by Voice of the Vikings, Paul Allen, breaking down last night's big Vikings win in the border battle against the Packers.
Super Bowl champions.
Yeah, they're done.
Amazing.
The season's over, guys.
Fantastic.
Yeah, Vikings won the championship.
I really
championship.
Championship. I really do want this to be like
as a chip.
I want this to be the start of just an amazing rest of the season.
I know.
Ooh.
This needed to happen for that to happen.
I know.
So yes, yeah. So if we're gonna have an amazing sort of end of the season, last month of the season, yeah. Nice push, get some momentum, get that playoff spot. Last night absolutely needed to happen. The scary thing is, man, we got the Patriots.
We got a rough schedule ahead of us. Yeah, yeah.
We got the Seahawks.
I got the list here.
My mighty Miami Dolphins come to town.
Yeah,
they're terrible, by the way.
Lions, and then
say it.
Stupid fish.
Glove, glove. Oh, yeah. Also, Lion, and then and Bears. Yeah.
Stupid.
Oh. Yeah, it's a rough.
Yeah, we got a very rough rest of the schedule. And the Bears, meanwhile, who have that, you know, the 8-3 record and the lead in the NFC North, they have a pretty easy schedule going forward.
Yeah. So, that's not fair, man.
Last
Lions,
game
Bears,
of the season,
Dolphins, oh my.
That Vikings-Bears game in the final week of the season could be massive. That could be the game that decides the NFC North.
All right, so a couple things here real quick. We're going to get into a bit of how the how local media... not only are they an extension of the DFL's propaganda promotion campaigning, but they're also encouragers of DFL officials and candidates. But before we dive into this ridiculous article, Andrew Langer brought something up in the middle of our conversation with him, and it reminded me of this, that if you were paying attention at all to national media, right, over the weekend, you would know that there were these massive, violent protests taking place in France over the gas tax.
Yeah.
These were huge, right? These were headline-making Fox News alert stuff. If you looked, because I did, at local media, nothing. Because the first thing I thought of was walls. First thing I thought of was the wanting to, you know, raise our gas taxes here. Yeah,
absolutely. And, that was his response. Absolutely.
Absolutely,
he said. You guys are all going to be paying a lot more for gas because I don't think you're paying enough.
We need to invite some of the citizens of France here.
Right.
So you need to come. Can you come over here? Help us out.
Those protests and riots were insane.
They were
too.
Insane.
Those there were just things just exploding.
I'm not suggesting that we do that here in Minnesota. Don't miss it, because I know someone will say, John wants rioting in the streets over the gas tax. Yeah. No, the point is that, man, this is not just, we're going to do this and it's going to be fine. You know, you'll pay a little more.
Right.
No, man, this is wrong. Flat out wrong. People are rioting in France because of it. And the media is ignoring it.
The French to riot?
Seriously, right?
Yeah, right.
they're lovers, not fighters. And they're weird lovers, but they're still lovers.
Aren't they?
Just saying, that's always been the thing, right?
You're not speaking from personal experience.
No, I'm not speaking from personal experience at all. I am not. So I saw that over the weekend, and I was like, oh, isn't that interesting? They're taking to the streets to protest. In the meantime, our media ignores that while still trying to prop up those individuals holding office. Star Tribune article, fresh from big Minnesota wins.
Oh, God.
Senator Amy Klobuchar swept up in presidential speculation. Yeah, because you're doing it.
You're the one speculating.
You're the one sweeping her up in it.
They do this every single cycle, every time. I cannot tell you how many times I've read this exact same article. They fangirl over Amy Klobuchar worse than any relationship between media and a politician I've ever seen in my entire life. I've lived in a bunch of places.
It's a mystery to me.
They just adore her.
I don't understand why. She's not necessarily a pleasant individual. Now, what's funny about this is so just real quick here. Okay, so this is a lengthy piece. I mean, again, I did the cut and paste to trim it down, and it's still three pages after I reduced the font and got rid of all the photos. But you look at the excuses they use. So first they talk about the U.S. Senate fight over Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. So
she was so great in that.
Right.
She was so wonderful.
So they project.
Oh, she was amazing.
Based off of that.
Yeah, when she asked those questions.
Then they say she's made various public remarks recently about the political importance of Midwestern states, and they take that as a sign. So they project, this is the moment for the Midwest, and we don't want to be forgotten again in the national election. So they,
like Hillary Clinton did?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, because Trump didn't forget the Midwest. You know, so if she's looking for somebody who actually paid attention to the Midwest, she should consult with our current president, Donald Trump, because he did not ignore the Midwest like Hillary Clinton did, and he won.
So they extrapolate from those two things, right, that could be indications. Mm. Then they say she's not talked publicly of any interest in running for the presidency, did not grant an interview for the story, but her longtime political advisor said that she's still thanking people who helped her lead a major winning ticket in Minnesota. So even the political advisor doesn't grab onto it. Okay. Then they get to this, right? Klobuchar has had at least one conversation about a national campaign with a man who's been a political mentor and who once led a presidential ticket himself. Former Vice President Walter Mondale said in an interview that about 5 months ago, he urged Klobuchar to run for president. So,
okay.
So they extrapolated, she denied it, then they have a story about Mondale asking her,
right.
Then they spend the whole rest of the bulk of the article talking about all, it is an exercise of grand speculation about how they so desperately want her to run.
Yeah, they really, really do. They really, and keep in mind, Walter Mondale thought he should run for president. So his judgment is already in question.
Don't understand.
Because he did, and did real poorly, if I remember correctly.
Wait a second, guys, are we looking at this wrongly? Hold on a second. Maybe we're looking at this all wrong.
Are we?
Yeah. Maybe. Okay. We're right. Maybe Amy Klobuchar is indeed a really unpleasant person. and this is all a ruse because they want her to run because they don't want her associated with us anymore.
Ah, they want her, they want her political career to come to an end?
Yes! Yeah, no, maybe this is the long game here because they see what we see. And that this is a, how do we get rid of her? I know, have her run for the presidency. She'll have to leave office, potentially, and then she won't.
They adore her.
Right. Love her so much.
They're like teenage girls at a One Direction concert when it comes to Amy Klobuchar.
They're not. Are they still together anymore?
Maybe. I don't know. One Direction?
Yeah.
The reference still works. Okay.
Does it?
I mean, they all have solo careers. I don't think they're still putting out music together.
Does it still work?
Yes.
You know
what I mean.
Maybe. Your joke was
very like 2016.
Yeah. You should have gone with a bunch of teenage girls at a Creed concert. That would have been.
That
totally works. Teenage way better.
You know, modern day teenage girls love them some Creed.
Do concerts anymore? That's a terrible reference.
Yours was better. I'll give you.
Right. I'll give you that. Taylor Swift. Can I do Taylor Swift?
That would work.
Yeah, fangirling over here. Like, they act like Sam fangirling over Taylor Swift.
Oh, don't even get me started.
See, there you go, right there. That's the Star Tribune talking about Amy Klobuchar.
They quote Will Bunch, a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, who wrote, "If you went into a lab and ran Tuesday's algorithms to design the perfect Democrat for 2020, she would look almost exactly like Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar."
What?
Really?
What?
Wow, that's a stretch.
Will Bunch? What is wrong with you?
Weird thing. I've honestly never seen anything like this before. I mean, unless you look at like sort of the fawning over a Beto or the fawning over Obama, but I've never seen a local outlet like the Star Tribune,
I know.
Zero in on an individual like they have with Amy Klobuchar and just fangirl over her.
I've said it a number of times. Whatever. For everything that I disagree with Amy Klobuchar on, I'll give her credit. She's got an amazing PR machine around her because she manages to get her name mentioned for every single possible opening, whether it's presidential run, once a presidential run has been decided and she's not in it, then it becomes vice presidential speculation. Will they select Amy Klobuchar when there's a Supreme Court opening under Obama? Her name got mentioned over and over and over. Whoever is behind, I don't think she's ever going to do anything but be a senator.
No, I don't think so either.
She's got an easy gig.
Yeah.
We saw last Tuesday, she can win re-election without barely lifting a finger.
Yeah, we say that, though, but look what happened with Ellison. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring the house down. I apologize.
Wow.
Here, let's mock some other Democrat potential 2020 candidates. Two Democrats in the Senate, both saying they are eyeing the party's 2020 presidential nomination, have announced their so-called basic income plans for America's lower income families. Would you guys like to know some details?
Yes.
I suppose I have to.
Senator Kamala Harris, Democrat out of California, unveiled her Lift the Middle Class Act.
Okay.
It would provide, are you ready for this? It would provide a tax credit of up to $6,000 a year to families earning less than $100,000 a year, and a credit of up to $3,000 for those earning less than $50,000 a year.
You could be making $95,000 a year.
What?
Like, as an individual.
Yeah.
Like as a single person.
That is...
And you're going to get a $6,000 tax credit because Kamala Harris just wants to take money away from some people and give it to you.
That is this Lift the Middle Class Act is the example of how that definition of middle class is such a moving target.
Right.
Because nine times out of ten, you would never consider anybody making, above like $60,000 a year or 70, certainly not 80 or 90 as middle class. Most of the time, that's reserved upper middle. But you could do 100,000. It's a moving target, though.
How did she land on the $6,000, too?
I have no idea. Who knows? I mean, none of this is cost effective. The Tax Policy Center estimated that Harris's plan would add $2.8 trillion to the federal deficit over its first decade and another $3.4 billion over its second decade. There's just no respect. We'll just print more.
Just print more money. It's fine.
Harris tweeted, "Middle class families deserve to know that one unexpected cost won't lead to a financial emergency. That is literally like 99% of families out there. Lower, middle, upper class, a massive unexpected cost could lead to a financial emergency, could lead to hard times financially for a while. The key is, you know, making good decisions and planning and being able to withstand those financial crises, those periods of months where, you know, my car died. And I have to get a new car, and I wasn't planning on getting a new car. Or my refrigerator died. I have to go buy a new refrigerator. I had an unexpected medical expense. You know, every family has to deal with those sort of things.
The genius of what she said, though, is that, again, talk about a moving target. I can tell you up front that an extra $6,000 a year would not have done me much good at all for my two open heart surgeries and infected hematoma in between right? with a heart attack. That right? would have been like, oh, yeah, that's a nice little Band-Aid that fell off in the water. Fix. It wouldn't have done, you know. But this, when you look at Cory Booker's, his proposal, and we talked about this, he wants to create opportunity accounts.
Ooh, that's a good name.
For the nation's children, which would grow to $46,000 per child by the time they turn 18. Cory Booker wants to give my sons $46,000 when they're 18 years old.
Yeah.
That's a horrible idea. That's
a really bad idea.
That's a really, yeah. really...
As the father of an 18-year-old.
That's a bad...
Yeah, if he just walked into $46,000...
Oh, my gosh.
My goodness, the terrible decisions he would make.
Well, that's why we asked Langer before, you know, is this going to be the norm? I think for now it's going to be the norm. I think for now your top Democrats running for office, I would be surprised to see a moderate gain a lot of traction among Democrats.
Well, with ideas like these floating around out there, yeah, it's going to be really tough for a sane, moderate Democrat to really cut through and get noticed because they're all just trying to outstupid one another right now.
You said sane Democrat. That's a funny joke. 651-989-5855. You can use #250 and say TC&T or Twin Cities News Talk if you want to reach out to us. We do have more nonsense to get to later on next hour. City Council is going to take another look at food stocking requirements for stores. We will dive into that. But first,
Voice of the Vikings, Paul Allen, joins us.